Welcome to another episode of Open Science Radio. This time it's number 101, and we thought, okay, let's make a little wordplay with this. So 101, we use as a small introduction into open science. We think that most of the listeners here should have already a rough understanding of what open science is, but maybe we can fill some gaps, or maybe you can refer this episode to somebody who is not so far in this topic. With me is, as usually, Matthias. Hi, Matthias.
Hello.
Yeah, so we have a clear plan ahead of us, which is not so common. we always have a plan, but this time it is pretty clear. We would like to teach you what is actually open science. And I think this is kind of hard from this perspective that it's built from or has different facets, and that people might name these facets differently and might see different facets in there as well. But I'm pretty sure we at least give you kind of a introduction that might help you and guide you through this very roughly. Okay, the starting point of this is often, the so-called research cycle is used, and we want to do exactly the same thing. So we will use the research cycle, which is the common workflow that you use when you do actual research, when you do science. And the whole thing is a little bit based on a workshop toolkit that Andreas Leimbach and me set up once together, because we're doing these kind of workshops from time to time, and we do this always in the same style, actually taking this research cycle and guiding people through this. And we have a figure here, so if you're listening to this and you can, somebody who needs an image, there will be a small image posted here on the website of the Open Science Radio. And you can have a look at this. So I will try to guide you through this. Okay, let's assume you're a scientist and you want to do research. Usually your research cycle consists of 8 different points. And at first you have an idea. Huh? You read something, you have an idea, you want to prove or disprove a theory or make a new hypothesis. So you have this idea, and then you sit down and you design roughly your study. You think, how can I answer this biological, or sorry, this, I'm a biologist or I work in life science, so can you answer your scientific question? Often this kind of endeavor is, well, it cannot be done simply with thin air, but you have to get some money for this. So you have to get financing. You often have to write a grant in order to get your future research funded. Once you have your financing, you start actually with an acquisition of data that should support or disprove your theory. Once you have your data acquired, you need to analyze that data. You might have to go back, have another data acquisition and so on. So there's kind of an iterative process. But then you have your data analysis, and in the end, you hopefully think, okay, I have now improved the humankind's knowledge, and I need to write this down and make it public to other people. So for this, you sit down and you write a manuscript, which is basically a compilation of your observations and the conclusions that you made out of that. Once you have this manuscript, you would like to give it to other people in order to read it. And for this, you submit it to a journal, and that journal will usually perform peer review. So it will ask other scientists to carefully read your manuscript and give feedback regarding it, and tell either what should be improved or even completely discarded. So basically that it's not published with this publisher, with this journal. And once this peer review is done, the actual publication takes place, and hopefully somebody else is reading your new study and has an idea again. So And with this, the circle is closed. So I, stepwise, or maybe just as a repetition, so we have the idea, we have the study design, we have the financing, we have the data acquisition, we have the data analysis, we have a manuscript, we have peer review, and we have a publication. So this classic workflow should be more or less existing in all fields of science. And now we can think, how can we make this open? And maybe first as a motivation, why should we make stuff open? Well, and Matthias and me, we mentioned this several times already. In principle, we don't want to do this open science radio. Okay, Matthias, yes, you want to do this, and me as well. I agree. But the point is that in principle, we are strong believers that open science is actually good science, or it's good scientific practice, and that we're currently in a state which is not ideal, so that you, in principle, could do much better science by opening up all these aspects of the research cycle. Please.
Yeah. I mean, because it needs to be accessible in order to be the basis for other people's science to build upon, or to find differences, or to be the blueprint, or whatever you would like to do it. But also, from my point of view, for example, as being not a scientist at all, for me, it's incredibly helpful in my professional career if I have science or research available to me in all kind of manners, not only the article, but the article is basically always the starting point. I'm looking for something that has been researched in science, or that has been scientifically examined or observed. And of course, as working in an industry company, we don't usually have access to the research magazines, right? So I will always turn to open access available scientific articles in order to look for what is the current state of the research regarding one certain aspect. And maybe I will later turn towards closed access articles too, if it's necessary. But I will always start, and possibly in most of the cases, stay with the open articles or with the open access articles. And mm-hmm. if there's data attached that I can use in order to test something, or just try to figure out what has been done to this data and how it has been processed, that's extremely helpful, even if you're not inside the scientific system at all.
So basically, this transparency is in a way a key feature of science, right? If you really want to fully understand the scientific process, and so the whole cycle, you ideally would like to have access to all these different facets in order to understand it and to, well, really, yeah, believe it. No?
Yeah.
And Matthias mentioned this already, the first thing, and maybe the crystallization point of everything is actually open access, meaning that you, as a somebody who is not paid for it, basically, has access to the manuscript that was published, so the actual publication. Well, saying that you have not paid for this is maybe imprecise, because in principle, you as a taxpayer have paid for this research in some ways. The classical way of how people are getting access to such a publication is that the libraries of universities are paying publishers money to get access to such a manuscript, or to journals, actually. And if you think about this, this is kind of weird. Let's have a look at this. I'm, as a scientist, I'm paid by the public, and we discussed before, I'm putting, you know, a lot of effort in going through this research cycle, and in the end I produce a piece of work, so a study or a results of my research, and I write down a piece of paper, a manuscript, and I give it to a publisher. The publisher has an editor, and this editor is often also a person who is actually a scientist who volunteers to run this journal, or to basically doing the scientific lead of this journal. he or she will read my manuscript very roughly and will then send it out to peers, to other scientists from that field that should, well, read it more carefully and give feedback, the so-called peer review. Interestingly, they are also doing this voluntarily. So they do this because they think this is part of their work as scientist. And once they're done with this, and let's say the editor says, okay, the publication is fine, then I, the author, basically sign a piece of paper telling, yes, all this content is now the property of that publisher. And you can do whatever you want with this. And what the publisher does is actually, well, they reformat it a little bit and put it on their server behind a so-called paywall. Basically, only libraries, as mentioned, the libraries pay money for this, that scientists from that university can access this publication. So this means there are a lot of publicly funded people involved in the process of generating this knowledge. And then this piece of work is given as property to this publisher, which is, in my opinion, rather weird. And I'm not the only one thinking this. Over time, people said in the end, okay, we need a different type of doing this and or a different way of financing that. And there was the so-called open access movement starting. And open access means basically that people without such a subscription can access to this. There are different models of open access. The one which is maybe the most prominent one is the so-called golden open access, where people, so basically the author, pays the publisher money in order to make the publication accessible. Another one is the so-called green way, where the publisher grants the author the right to put the manuscript on a so-called repository. This can be either an institutional repository from the university or somewhere else where people can access this stuff. There's a slight difference often that the golden open access has a proper open license, and we get to the licenses a little bit later. They are often so-called Creative Commons licensed works. There's maybe, well, a third one, which is called Diamond Open Access or Platinum Open Access, where actually the publisher is not charging the author for the open access, but it's basically funded in different ways, for example, by a foundation or so. So we have these three different types: golden, green, and platinum or diamond open access. And with this, also people like Matthias, who are actually not working in a scientific institution, have access to this. And also other people, like, for example, a patient who would like to read something about their medical treatment, have access to this. And they get actually something they've paid for,
right,
with their taxes.
Yeah.
All right. So with this, we are already one step further, and there was a lot of energy put into this to make open access, let's say, a widespreadly used method. We are not yet there that all the journals actually are open access, and it's also questionable if we get there so soon, but at least there's a tendency to get there. There are also alternative approaches to basically replace the publishers completely by basically infrastructure. Basically, a publisher is nothing else than a infrastructure, if you want to see it like this, to make the prices much lower than they are right now, because you still pay a lot of money for open access. And there are several studies showing that the price could be much, much lower than they are right now. Mm. And, well, this is already good. This means the final result of the research process is accessible. But as Matthias mentioned before, he would like to have access to everything, right? To all the pieces before. And let's try to think for each facet what could be done here. Let's start with the step before the actual publication. There's the open, or there's the peer review process, and also the peer review process could be open, which is where's the term open peer review. Matthias, would you like to say something about that?
I mean, the standard in the academic publishing system is that before a article is published, some of the where some other researchers of the same basic peer, so usually it's the same topic and or connected topics in some respect, will have a look at the article to be published and provide some feedback, whether this seems to be, I don't know, I'm not sure about the terminology here, but whether this seems to be reasonable research, whether this is valid data based on the methodology used, based probably also on the data acquired. And what you usually get out of this is a recommendation to that the paper is either published or needs to be reviewed somehow, or revised somehow. That's what I meant. So some aspects need to be changed, and these kind of range from, okay, please provide a bit more background on a certain aspect of it. Please change some kind of aspect in your analysis in order to pay attention to a certain bias or whatever this is. But it could also be kind of more general. And of course, this is one of the critical points in respect to peer review is sometimes you're feeling this, okay, my reviewer is specifically leaving a comment in order to get his own opinion a bit more respected in the paper. So this is one of the one of these individual related, socially motivated aspects of peer review that of course comes into play when you have humans to deal with, right? So there are many aspects that need to be taken into account when it comes to peer review and open peer review. And the basic idea is if you have a peer review and you have dedicated persons looking at the paper before it's been published, that this is kind of, this has many aspects that can be criticized. One being that this is also a close group that maybe offers not the best advice or not enough advice, or may work as a gatekeeper. But it also is criticized in respect to, do you need something like peer review at all? And of course, it's criticized in respect to most of the peer reviewers, if not all, are doing this for free. So you basically have another cost factor that is pushed away from the publishing companies to the scientific system itself. And that's kind of often the one argument that you hear in public that causes a lot of, well, face palming, I would say. Right?
Yeah. And well, it's often debatable if it's needed at all. There was a long time in scientific history where no peer reviewing was done. Still, I think it's most of the time a good idea, but I could also imagine there are certain cases where it's actually not the case. And yeah, well, the different ways of how open peer review can be done, and we see this already out there in the wild. I mean, it can be also that only people are basically, or the actual reviews are then posted. It can be that only the names of the people are posted. One good example is Faculty 1000 Research, where you where the article is actually published. And by the way, this is some of the weird thing. In principle, you know, today you can publish stuff simply by putting it on a web server, then it is publicly available, right? So published means that you have an accepted publication in general. The article is completely checked in there. But basically, in this open peer review, you can, for example, have it like in Faculty 1000 Research, where you basically have the article roughly checked, then it's online available, and then the peers are stepwise, the reviewers are stepwise adding their comments there, and then in the open people can read this and can see what kind of changes were demanded and how they were addressed later on.
Which is also really helpful, just to jump in for a second, which is also really helpful if you are about to write your first article, because this gives you an insight of what a peer review could look like, what kind of comments can you expect, what needs to be done afterwards. So this is, especially a faculty 21,000 research, which makes it really transparent, the whole peer review process, is also really helpful as an information tool in order to help you find your way of writing articles and publishing articles.
Absolutely, this is very important. And it can be also that such a peer review can be actually an important piece of scientific work, right? That you, as a peer reviewer, contribute significantly by pointing out maybe an important flaw or something like this inside of a study. And it's from this perspective a problem that this is not appreciated or not measured really. So if you're applying for a job, and this is, we'll get to this a little bit, the whole incentive system. If you apply for a job, well, in the end, you just show your list of publications. But these kind of contributions, they are not part of that. So there are meanwhile platforms like Pablons, for example, where you can list your peer review work and show also there that you are a contributing member of the scientific community by helping others getting or increasing the quality of their study. Yeah, I guess this is the facet of peer review. Matthias, do you have anything to add?
Yeah, I mean, it turned out over the last couple of years, my impression at least of peer review, especially of those peer review that's open to the public, indeed, often turned out to work along the lines of a good scientific blog and the comment section in a blog. And we have had this over a number of episodes where we have kind of referred to blog post articles and then mentioned to our listeners to explicitly take a look into the comment section, because a lot of the discussions in the comment section is actually really contributing to the whole topic and is really worthwhile reading and even engaging into this discussion sometimes. And especially having open up peer review and letting a wider peer group also be able to leave comments and thereby to kind of offer some kind of review of this article is really something that seems to me to work properly in the most cases and to actually also contribute something worthwhile.
Yeah, the keyword is post-publication peer review, and I think this is a very good point, Matthias, pointing this out, and this guides me back to one thing that we should maybe mention in general. A lot of the things that we're doing still today is due to historical reasons. I'm confident that if we would invent scientific communication and science itself today from scratch, it would look very, very different. Mm. This is mostly due to the fact that, let's say, several hundred years ago, some people who could afford to do some research as a hobby or something like this, they did their experiments and wanted to communicate their results to their peers. So they started sending letters around. At some point, they figured out, I need to write too much letters. We need somebody who's taking care of this. Voila, the classical publishers were born. And also the format is still the same in perspective. We have this fixed articles that are put around or put up and then can be read. If you think in, especially what Matthias said now, in a more dynamic way, that you have kind of a blog where you can put a post, you get comments, and well, you can even change that. Yeah? You can make updates right in that blog post, for example. We do not use this kind of stuff too much in science because we are so much trained in the old fashioned of doing this, and this is can be rather hampering. And as said, I think we would do this rather differently if we start from scratch, and having this transition, especially due to the fact that we are still judged also based on this old system, makes it very hard to bring science to the level where it could be today.
Yeah.
So basically the digitalization and the internet have changed a lot.
Yeah.
And it's not all arrived here.
I mean, we see that a lot with basically a lot of the subsystems of society. Some methods of doing things have been established over a certain number of years, if not decades or even centuries. And now that the system has grown around it and incorporated these methods, it's hard to change them because A, you have a lot of people to actually adapt to this change and change their behavior and change their motivational thoughts about this or in incentives on the gratifications that they get from handling things like they have done before. And of course, you have also a number of very powerful players opposing the change because they have become established through handling certain things in a certain way over the last couple of centuries. And by changing these ways, it would mean that they have to change as well, risking at least a certain amount of whatever they get from this, be it earnings or profit or maybe only recognition whatsoever, or reputation rather, right?
They have a lot of stakes in there. And this is, we maybe at this point refer to a rather recent Open Science episode with Björn Brems regarding this, episode 98, where we're exactly discussing this. And yes, I'm pretty convinced there are people working, for example, in these publication houses that do a great job. They maybe even love their job and doing this very well. It's just, in my opinion, the wrong direction. Yeah? And not all of them are evil or whatever, but they are, as Matthias said, a kind of a subsystem that is trying to survive, despite the fact that there could be a much better global solution for that. And this is, with all these structures that we will discuss with this whole research cycle itself, it is very hard to make a transition, and due to the fact that these, let's say, old and established forces are there. Still, we need to do this because we will have a better science afterwards. Yeah. Okay, a lot of points that we are covering here in this point. So I suggest we leave peer review and move to the other facet called manuscript. And already there are several points attached to. We said before, well, you have your manuscript and you send it usually out for peer review before it can be published. And we also saw already this conflict, what actually means published. The issue is the following. This peer review can actually take quite a while. I myself had one article, for example, more than 1.5 years in peer review. And this means 1.5 years, nobody else has access to the knowledge I have generated. And if you keep in mind that this means that people not having access to this knowledge cannot build upon this knowledge and cannot come up with better ideas or can improve it or can modify their study based on this. If you think in this kind of delay is absolutely counterproductive for efficient advance of humankind's knowledge.
It can be even dangerous if you look at medical topics, right? We have had over the last couple of years, we have seen a number of medical crises, be it in relation to a certain disease or some other factors. The faster your valid research is available, the better it is for the public because others can read, others can build upon it, others can deviate from it and try different ways of solving a certain problems, right? And we have seen a lot of movement of specifically in the medical sector to kind of fasten up the whole process of peer review and publication in a different manner, like with the latest Zika crisis.
Exactly. So there's a clear motivation to make this kind of stuff accessible much earlier. And one of these solutions are so-called preprint servers. And again, here this naming is kind of due to this old workflow. But basically what a preprint server is a place where you can put your manuscript before the actual peer review. Can put it there that people have access to this, can read this stuff, knowing, okay, this is not yet controlled by peers, but it's a crude and maybe even an early version of something. And by this, you might also give people the possibility to give feedback to you and to improve your current work already. But the main motivation is to give access to this. And this is interesting how different, let's say, communities are dealing with this. So I said I'm coming from life sciences, and there the first Preprint servers are rather fresh. They are rather new. So, for example, BioArchive is something that just popped up some years ago. In math and in physics, the most prominent preprint servers archive is around since quite a while, and it's widely used. And there you see how these different communities using this for physicists. Putting a manuscript on archive is actually the timestamp. It's clearly, okay, I did this. While in life sciences, at least at the time it's more like people are still afraid putting their work there as they are afraid of getting scooped, that basically somebody else take the work and is publishing this. I see at least the trend there that it's getting better, but it's not so widely accepted as, let's say, in physics. Mm.
Yeah, and you see, in the recent month, you see quite some efforts to actually use preprint servers and build up journals upon those, right? I think they are called overlay journals, that give you a journal-like reading experience just based on papers that have been published in preprint servers.
Mm-hmm. It's basically they use these preprint servers as kind of the backend for storing the manuscript, and then have a thin layer of peer reviewing there, that is, or technology that is taking care of the peer reviewing. And I think this is also a very good and cost effective way of doing this. So we might see this much more often.
Yeah,
hopefully. Okay, also something that's going in this direction, and it's a little bit harder to put this directly into open science, but it's at least harvesting modern technologies of the recent times. So the whole thing I mentioned before is that kind of the digitalization and the internet brought a lot of ways of improving our scientific approaches. And if you wrote a manuscript before, you might have done this in, a normal office suit like Word or whatever, send around this manuscript to different collaborators, always with version X and so on, which can be quite cumbersome and can be quite ugly and has a lot of friction. Today we have tools like Google Docs or other tools for collaboratively writing things together, and they can increase the speed and making this much more friction, or remove a lot of friction out of that whole system.
Hmm. Some tools that are really, really famous or well known in the scientific community is, for example, Overleaf. And there has been another one that was called Authoria. I think it also still exists. So those two are basically platforms for collaborative writing, and they have a lot of functions implemented that are typically for scientific writing, which is, for example, a system for properly quoting, a system to properly linking to other papers by just typing in their DOI, and then you have all the quotes and the citations for this paper ready. So if you haven't had so far, take a look at those two.
Mm. And they are actually having even templates for different journals, which is also very handy. Yeah, and for some of the journals, you can directly submit from Overleaf, for example, to those journals. I think eLife, for example. Yeah. Okay, so let's say your manuscript is done, yeah? But we said before, the step before actually writing the manuscript is that you have done some data analysis. And for this, with a growing amount of data, you often use, let's say, a programming language like Python or R. Or you might use more sophisticated tools that are part of or developed as part of a community effort. And or you might even use a commercial product for doing this. And here one issue starts. If you use a commercial product for performing your data analysis, people that do not have access to this tool might not be able to perform this step. And this is why making also your analysis public, and for example, adding this as supplementary material, or even better, making this available on a source code sharing platform like GitHub or something like this. With this, you provide people the potential or the capability to actually reproduce what you did, and especially as a computational biologist as I am, I can really can say this is very important. And can save a lot of time because often you try to replicate something or you try to apply a method to your own data set and you have to start from scratch if you only have to have basically a very short method part in a paper and you need to do everything from scratch and you, for example, parameters are not described. You have a hard time doing this. And it's very easy actually for us to put then the analysis script or whatever used for this as part of your publication out there. And you can also share this from the beginning on. Well, the tool itself is one part, but you also need to have the data itself. So this was basically the data analysis part. If you go now to the facet of data acquisition, once you've generated the data, you should also make this accessible as part of your publication, or ideally maybe even earlier. So if I have the tool and I have the data, I can exactly reproduce what was done in order to come from the original data to the conclusions made upon that. So these two pieces, open data and basically open source software, are essential part for increasing the reproducibility, for making stuff transparent, and also to making stuff more frictionless. It might be also, and this is another motivation for open data, that somebody would like to reuse your data, so that that he or she comes up with a different idea or a different perspective on the data to answer a different scientific question.
Or maybe not even a scientific question. I lately had an example where we tried to implement a new algorithm that was doing something, and in order to test it, we had to generate a lot of test data. And after a while, we kind of found that there was a research group looking into the exact same things. And they actually had published the data that they used, which we could directly use as test data. And it was kind of a really large data set. We wouldn't have been able to generate such a large number of test cases at all. And even generating just a limited amount of test cases would have cost us like 2 weeks. So instead of generating everything by yourself, we could directly use it, and it saved us not only 2 weeks' time, but it gave us a lot more precision in testing our algorithms. And that's basically what can also happen inside science, right? You can reuse data. It gives you an indication of what data you might need in addition to that. But it might also give you a good test bed for testing your algorithms.
Great example. Okay, some things you have to keep in mind when you generate open data, and also if you generate open source software, is choosing the right license, right? Per default, you have actually copyright on whatever you're producing, and this default copyright, and it depends a little bit on the region of the world you're located in, but This default copyright that you have can hamper actually the reuse of your data and of your code. And there are different licenses that help you to make this easier for, or make it easier for other people to reuse your data and your source code. We do not dive too deeply into this, but there are so-called Creative Commons licenses that are used or can be used for data, by the way, also for publications. So if you have an open access article, this is often published under a so-called Creative Commons license. You have for open source software, you have different licenses like the GPL or BSD licenses, all with a slightly different flavor or different focus. As said, we will not dive too deep into this, but if you are intending to put your source code out there, or if you intend to put your data out there, look for this for these open licenses. And for open data, there's also, it's also important to look for the right repository. Yeah, so the different types of data have repositories that are really made for this. And an essential part of publishing data is also publishing the metadata about it in order to make it reusable. And these repositories often take care of that. Anything to add, Matthias, to open data or to open source?
I mean, especially the kind of world that we look in that shares the similarities in between open data, open source, and the connected licenses that you should use in order to make everything really reusable in any respect. And oftentimes open licenses from the Creative Commons section are used in a way that people think like, yeah, you can have my data, but please don't sell it inside your own product or something like that. So this is basically a whole topic in itself. And this can become really difficult, especially if you look at, you are already using somebody else's method, tool, or license, or data set, and now you add your own one. So you have like inherent license agreements already in your, so this becomes really, really difficult. But my impression was the community that is dealing with these questions is really open and helpful. So if you don't know, look at your own institution, who can actually help you with it. And many institutions nowadays come with or have established kind of a team that deals with questions of open science, open access, how to publish, where to publish, and all these aspects. And reach out into the community and ask around whether there's something that can help you. And usually you will get feedback that is valuable for you.
Hmm. Yeah, exactly. And try to remove these hurdles. In respect to data, there are the so-called FAIR data principles that we should mention here as well. And FAIR is an acronym that stands for findable, accessible, interoperable, and reusable. And this is what Matthias basically mentioned. You know, there might be different societies or different communities that have different ideas of how to work with the data, but they will all try to align to these FAIR data principles and, well, recommend solutions that are taking care of that. So these FAIR data principles are essential guidelines or rough directions you should aim for. And as we're talking to a broad audience from different parts of science, you should try to then figure out in your own community what are the standards there. Or if there are no standards before, try to push them. Well, this might be also something. It's still, everything is in the flow and can be definitely improved.
Yeah. And maybe a shameless self-plug. We have a number of episodes dealing with a number of tools and questions around these, how to publish your data openly, how to make it available, what tools to use, what might be helpful. So just look for the tag inside the Open Science Radio, and you will get a first instance of where to look elsewhere, and that guides you into the maybe a useful direction.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. Okay, I guess this is it regarding data acquisition. We said before, okay, you might need money for your endeavor, and for this, basically, you have to write a grant. And this is something that needs, in my opinion, much more, where much more practice is required. It's basically open grants, so that you have access to grants that are well funded, or maybe also not. I mean, you can learn so much when you sit down, and again, what Matthias mentioned before, if you have your first peer review or your first publication, it's good to have early feedback. But it's also, if you have a grant that you would like to write, it would be just very helpful to see other people's grants in order to see what worked and what didn't. And putting grants out there would help others to write it. You could even do this in such an open way that you get feedback for that.
I mean, one essential part of proposal writing, at least from my own experience, is you have to take a first look at what's already there in the research literature and what's going on in the research world. And you can do that by doing a more or less extensive literature research, trying to find, okay, what are the similar questions that are already addressed in this in the academic literature. But it would be so much more helpful to look at current research projects that have just started and that have been funded, so grants have been provided to these projects, or maybe even at projects that are currently proposed to see what other groups are currently working on. Are there aspects that are currently already researched, and may I alter my own ideas a bit to offer more value, or to ask another question that is equally important but not as respected in the other application? So this might add a whole nother dimension of kind of a community-driven organization of what's been researched that I find mm-hmm. somehow useful, even though we have, of course, the law of or the right of science to be free of any interference by anybody. But I think that doesn't really oppose this.
Hmm. And actually close to connected to this, so if you go to the next facet, or the facet above the financing, is the study design, exactly what you just said, right? That also there people could design studies already together, that you put this out early and get early feedback, maybe change this year in order to get a better result, or to get a better understanding of what you're actually looking for. Yeah? So also this could be already, if done open, improved by peers, by other people who have a different perspective of everything. Yeah.
Yeah. And I think we will have two short examples of kind of services or journals or repositories, however you will call them, that basically are able or that offer to help in all the different facets. And proposal writing or grant application is one of these facets. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, and well, it also goes back to the idea, the very initial facet that we had. And so basically, with this, we have kind of the closed research cycle that started from the idea, study design, financing, data acquisition, data analysis, manuscript writing, peer review, and publication. That if we open this up, that we have in principle a better, a more efficient science that we can actually really trust and do not have to rely on some anecdotal observations that we cannot check and that we cannot prove. There are still some things that are now floating around that are not attached to these so far, and one is open lab notebooks. Basically, this means that you can write about your data acquisition, about your data analysis, but maybe also on other things like the idea and the study design, the financing, in something, for example, like a blog, and can get, as mentioned before, the feedback by the community. There is another thing that is floating around that is not attached or can be attached to all of those, is something which is called a citizen science. So far, we just talked about a professional person working inside of this workflow here, but we saw already, Matthias mentioned already, him not being a scientist, but working in a company, who might have or would like to have access to different parts or the whole workflow, and can even contribute to this. Citizen science is sometimes described that people running around collecting data for some scientists, but this is kind of only a small piece, right? In principle, citizen science could be that somebody has even his or her own idea or his or her own question that should be solved. Yeah. And for this, he can contribute as well to this. Yeah.
I think citizen science is one of these terms that are becoming clearer over time, that have become clearer over time, but that still lack a lot of definition and looking in detail into what can be done in citizen science, how you need to deal what's been done inside citizen science movements. So as soon as you go from, we have a number of non-experts, for example, collecting data or helping in order to analyze data, to recognize patterns, to compare different aspects. We have a number of examples given over time. But what actually happens when you have some non-scientists or someone outside the scientific system who wants to write a scientific paper? How are these, how is the whole process then incorporated into the scientific world? So I think there's a lot of questions that need still to be asked and answered.
Absolutely. But it's also important to practice this and also to make the bridge between science and the public, because in the recent years we saw a lot of mistrust, and in order to regain credibility, it's very important to embed people again into the process and see how this is happening. Not that we are some old people in white coats doing some weird experiments and burning a lot of taxpayers' money, right? It's important to see that this is a solid method of generating knowledge, and embedding people into this is, I guess, a great idea and should be already done at school and as early as possible.
Yeah. And I guess citizen science kind of holds one aspect that is valid for each and every step inside science. It's science communication, right? So the communication from someone inside the scientific system to the public, whoever is interested in the public, it might be different stakeholder groups like on the policy level, it might be the general public, it might be special interest groups. However, the basic motivation of science is to create knowledge for the society as a whole. And in order to distribute this knowledge, you can't only distribute it or circle it around your own peer group. You have to make it make it public and available, and you have to communicate it on a broader level in order to also have it understood by the wider society, and to kind of get an idea of what's the final goal with this. What can I do? How does it contribute to my daily life? Or maybe it doesn't contribute to my daily life at all, but maybe it contributes to prolonging my life in the end. So there's a lot of these aspects that have to do with making your research publicly known and recognized, and that's not only in terms of the scientific work and the scientific publication that you're doing, but I think it helps to open yourself up and show how you work, what you're working on, in order to recognize also you as a scientist.
Yeah, and I guess the keyword for this year are social media. So also you yourself should take care of communicating with the society via the social media, and well, also with your peers again, right? That you also get feedback there.
And even if you don't want to do it with your by yourself, communicating is a lot of effort and it's a lot of work. And if you don't have time because you're fully taken up by your own research, there are people out there helping you to communicate. Then it's maybe your PR department or your communication department. And I have seen over my life, when I was working inside the scientific world, I have seen many scientists that were really hesitant to actually talk to us as a communication department and let us kind of help them to communicate what they are doing and what they are working on. And I think this could be the first step, to just be open towards this communication to the outside world, because I think in the end, it also will help you, be it by feedback coming in or being by being recognized more openly, more often, maybe even by gaining reputation in places that you haven't considered. So all these kind of soft skills and or soft social factors might end up being useful to you.
Mm-hmm. Another thing that is floating around, not being attached to any of these facets so far, is the term open educational resources. So basically, the research process is generating knowledge, but it has to be also spread, as we mentioned now. But there are also classical things like textbooks that need to be updated in order to bring the newly generated knowledge to the people. And again, here we can make use of modern technologies to make this stuff more accessible. But we need also to keep in mind that open licenses can be helpful in order to reduce other hurdles here. And open educational resources are actually the keyword that is bringing all this together. So developing, for example, books online together, sharing this under a Creative Commons license, and by this making it easier to, disseminate the knowledge. Yeah.
And there are a number of initiatives around that have that are dedicated to specifically open education in this open science framework, be it software carpentry or data carpentry that help you, but also the open science MOOC, for example, or even the workshop toolbox that you have provided.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so this is basically a different piece, more about teaching. If you go on one step back and look at all what we said, you might say, yes, that's a great idea, opening up everything. I might even think this might help humankind. But if you're a scientist, you might say, but I will never do all that because this will kill my career. And this is what I mentioned before. So in the end, if you apply for a position, what you will mostly ask for is your list of publication. Yeah? If you apply for a job, you will have to compile your the works that you did. And this is basically the publications in scientific peer-reviewed journals. And if there is no science, nature, and cell on this, at least in life sciences, you might not get tenure or whatever. Yeah? And putting stuff before this out there, and basically, for example, your grant, for example, or your data, and at this already at very early points of your study, can harm your career. This is pretty clearly or need to be said clearly, right? And this has to change. This is definitely the whole bottleneck or the main issue here. From a technological perspective, everything can be implemented rather quickly or is already there. It is just that this incentive system that we are working in as a scientist is not necessarily facilitating this kind of openness. And we see, luckily, some places where this is changing. For example, the University of Munich in Germany has it's already a year ago or even more, announced, for example, a new job where people have to tell how they want to make their works open and have to present their open data and open science strategy, actually. And we see also that several funders see that if they ask for openness, their money that they spend into the funded grants, into the funded studies, that there is better outcome, that there's more outcome on a global scale. So this needs to change, and this is, I guess, also why we are doing this kind of podcasts here. We want to spread this. We need more awareness in this direction, and we need more movement in this direction. In the end, it's a collective action problem, right? We all have to pull the same line and change actually this incentive system to a place where also things like, well, as I said, open peer review, which is a very important scientific contribution, where this can be part of an evaluation for a new job, mm-hmm. or your recent dealing with data and open source, if you apply for a grant, that the committee that is evaluating your grant application will also look at your history of this and will tell you, okay, you did not publish your data in these studies. This is not good, and we would like to see this in future. Otherwise, we will not fund you anymore. Mm.
And I mean, I think we all get why this has become the way that it is. I mean, in a world that is where information is always growing, and that it's already past the point where we can actually have an overview or can get an overview of a certain aspect in its entirety, it becomes more and more complicated to get this kind of notion of this is something good and this is something bad, and that's why all these indices and all that have been developed to help us, to give us one clear information that is kind of built from a number of variables and a number of algorithms going through certain aspects. But in the end, there's more to this whole world than only numbers. And a number like an impact factor might not tell you about the work of a certain scientist in other places than publications, right? Because in the end, a publication is, of course, the result of a research process that has taken up some time already. But it's not the only activity. Totally, in the contrary, the result is only one activity in the end of a research process, or at defined steps inside the research process. And there's a lot of activity going on in the meantime. And this activity that goes on in the meantime is by far not less important than the result in the end and the publication in the end.
It's a very good point. We have not mentioned altmetrics here so far, which is an alternative way of measuring this, right? Well, there are different ways of doing this. We don't dive too much into this, but it's also important that this journal impact factor, which is one of the worst indicators for individual scientist's output or a manuscript, is really, it's badly used and should be banished completely. And by the way, also the data of generating this impact factor is not open. Yeah. Huh? So there are communities like Wikisite that try to improve this, that actually this data, the citation data, actually gets accessible. It is very hard to replace it because it's deep in the head of people judging journals and studies by impact factor, but this has to be removed. And as Matthias said, it's easier for people who need to evaluate this, but it's wrong. It's just wrong and leads to the wrong direction and the wrong incentives.
Because it disregards so many aspects.
Right.
Especially so many aspects that are important for those who actually finance the whole system, which is the taxpayer. Right?
Correct.
Yeah. I think it's... We mentioned already that there are two examples of services or platforms that might help you to cover a lot of these aspects that we have talked about in detail. Or more or less in detail, of course, and that might give you a better insight of what are all the activities inside research projects from the beginning to the end to the final publication, and maybe also help you to get a bit more information what's been doing inside the different steps and what are the outcomes of these steps. And I guess two of these that we have mentioned is the Open Science Framework and the RIO Journal, that you can take a look at and see a bit of what we've talked about this come into life. And that's, I guess, two points that I would mention at the end, or want to mention at the end.
Yeah. Yeah, it's very hard to cover here all the cool tools that are out there. We just thought about this episode as a conceptual overview about this, with some small examples in there in order to direct in a certain direction. And we hoped for this is more something to get the big overview, to get this research cycle a little bit in your head and how this can be opened. And we're pretty sure that if somebody else would do this, the same overview might have different facets in there and might have different points. And I think here at the end of this episode, we would like to invite you, give us feedback regarding this. As said, this is part of a toolkit for a workshop that we developed before. And if you think something very, very important is missing, let us know. And if you think something not so important is missing, please let us know as well. With this, I think we are at the end. Matthias, do you have anything to add?
I'm not sure whether we said it in the beginning. Of course, opening is a process, right? It's nothing that you can do with a snap of your fingers. It won't happen from today until tomorrow. And it won't happen at all facets at the same time. So many of those of the scientists that actually want to be more open and want to publish via open access and want to make data available do it gradually. So they're starting at whatever the easiest step is for them. Often it is publishing open access. However, this is also often connected to additional costs that arise because you have to pay with many legacy publishers to make your papers open, and then still they totally other discussion. But I think it's one step that you have to actively take, and from there it gets easier because you already have taken one step. And I think. And that's one thing that we want to stress with all the episodes that we give. There's always a first step that you actually can do. And we want to help you with finding out what this first step could be for you by providing you with some ideas of where you could look first. And it's also, of course, quite widely acknowledged that opening up the whole process is not valid for each and every research activity, right? There are cases where you don't want to open up everything. But we as a society have then at least to think about how to handle these exceptions and not to say for those openness is a complete no-go zone. I think openness should be the default, and then we have to kind of think about and define those cases that should not be revealed openly.
There might be, for example, medical data where you have then privacy concerns. This is all fine, but as Matthias said, this needs to be discussed in those cases, and the default should be clearly openness.
Because that's what science is in the end, right?
Exactly. Yeah. So we don't want to have open science at all. We want to have science, and this requires openness, transparency, reproducibility, all the things we covered here. Okay, Matthias, I think this was a tour de force through all these kind of topics. We hope we covered everything.
Indeed. Probably we didn't, but I mean, the research cycle itself has so many side bubbles and so many strengths that meander off. It really is hard, but it is a really helpful tool to get a first instant overview, and I think from there you have kind of ideas where to look for.
Yeah, I think this is, you know, this for us is a kind of a special episode because it's also maybe meant for people who are not always listening to Open Science Radio. Maybe this is something that you can give to somebody who you think might be interested in getting a little bit more overview about the whole topic. So maybe pass it to him or to her, and with our warmest recommendations. And maybe we produce more of these episodes that are helpful for you, and maybe also dive again into tools. We had already some about tools, and although this was in German. So please stay with us, listen to further episodes of this, and if you have questions, if you have suggestions, just let us know.
Right.
Okay. Thanks, Matthias. So let's say goodbye, and we talk again soon.
Right.
Bye.
Bye.